Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm very glad you have joined us. We're talking today about the recent U.S. Department of Justice report on the Baltimore Police Department and what it means for the department and the city going forward. The 14-month investigation into the BPD resulted in a biting 163-page report made public last month. The DOJ found that the police department routinely violated the civil rights of citizens, especially African Americans. Just a few of the findings: that officers performed illegal public strip searches, were overly aggressive with the mentally ill, and make several hundred thousand pedestrian stops a year with less than 4% resulting in a citation or arrest. Now, the city and the Department of Justice are negotiating the terms of a court-enforced agreement on how to address such problems. The DOJ has emphasized that it wants community input in the process. It's taking suggestions and recommendations through this week. We have information about contacting the DOJ on the Midday page at WYPR.org. And there's another way to make your voice heard. The University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law is holding one of several community town halls tomorrow night. Today we'll talk to two of the organizers of that town hall, law professor Michael Pinard and community activist and actress Sonia Sohn. But first, how effective are federal investigations in police departments? Has the process lived up to its promise in other cities? Washington Post investigative reporter Kimberly L. Kelly joins us by phone to help answer these questions. Last fall, she and a team that included PBS Frontline reported on the track record of federal interventions like the one the DOJ has conducted in Baltimore. For a piece titled Forced Reforms, Mixed Results, she and two other journalists did extensive reporting on 16 police departments where the feds have intervened at some point in the last two decades. Kimberly L. Kelly, welcome to Midday.
Thank you.
I'm very glad you could join us. How did the federal government come to have jurisdiction over local law enforcement?
Well, back in 1994, following the videotape beating of Rodney King, I mean, so many people remember that incident. Essentially, Congress empowered the Department of Justice to not only be able to go after, you know, individual officers, but at that moment, they empowered them to sue police departments for civil rights violations. So you're not just looking at one particular incident, but if there's a pattern of practice. And so that law has been on the books for a few decades now.
And you write that the Justice Department itself hasn't studied the long-term outcomes of these interventions. I mean, were you essentially, you and the team you worked with, essentially mm-hmm. starting from scratch?
Well, fortunately, they haven't studied the long-term outcomes, but they have been essential to documenting what's happened during those interventions. For example, when they go into a police department like L.A., they were there for 11 years. They have a federally appointed monitor or, you know, a judge who has to oversee the implementation of that reform, and that's probably what you'll see in Baltimore as well. And essentially, a judge will meet with you have a judge, you have a monitor who's managing the reform effort, and then you, of course, have the police department. And so these monitors work as somewhat of a liaison between the Department of Justice and the police departments, and they provide these reports that are actually filed in court. So there is documentation of the progress throughout the duration of these reforms. And like I said, in L.A. it was 11 years, Detroit it was about the same. And so you do see the documentation. The oversight that we reference is once that reform period ends, as was the case with Detroit and L.A. and a host of other departments, there's no look back to say, okay, well, did these things work?
So at that point, it falls back to the locality to continue to see whether or not things have worked and if they're still working, changes have been made.
Absolutely. And you just recently saw that with the Metropolitan Police Department here in D.C. They're actually one of the few, and I think potentially the only police agency actually in the last 30 decades that was investigated by the Department of Justice and then actually hired a consultant after the reforms ended to see what their progress had been years later.
And they found? Or they're still finding it.
Actually, they just released the report. I think it was a few months ago. It's very fascinating. And they basically went back and looked at the very things that it was the same monitor who actually had monitored their report. And he basically went back and looked at the things that they monitored at the same time to see what improved and what didn't improve. And so you see whether, you know, use of force has gone up by officers, if complaints have gone up. And I feel like, you know, they were pretty in depth in terms of what they took a look at. But it's rare that police departments actually do that, and it's even more rare that the Department of Justice, as an aggregate, looks back at the entire community of these investigations that they've overseen.
So can I ask you for an overall impression from all the work that you and your colleagues did? Tell us briefly what you found about how effective this consent decree process seems to have been in the cities where it's been used.
Well, one, the results were mixed, and that's why we ended up calling the story Force Reforms Mixed Results. In some departments, you saw that their use of force went down, and in other departments, you saw their use of force numbers increased. In some departments, you saw that the civilian complaints went down, and in others, you saw them increase. So there wasn't a singular standard that you saw happen among all police departments. And one thing I should actually saying there is, you know, you would automatically think that if the number of civilian complaints, if people are complaining more, that that's a bad thing. And one of the things that experts cautioned us is that that's actually a good thing for a time period, because essentially what it shows is that people are regaining trust in the police department enough to come forward and complain about a process, that when you actually see low complaints, that that could also be an indicative of the fact that there's no trust in the community, that nothing's going to happen if I file this complaint. I'm going to go, and this is going to fall on deaf ears, so I won't file complaints. So essentially what you see is there will be an uptick in the number of complaints for, you know, like 2, 3, 4 years, and then you'll see that number start to taper and then go down. But with use of force, the opposite is what a lot of police departments hope to see. They, you know, immediately want to see a decrease in that number. You know, they want to see fewer interactions between police officers and civilians that are either excessive force or just a different level of force, you know, so that you're not having those fatal encounters and maybe you're not, you know, handcuffing or people as much, or maybe you're not, you know, pulling your gun out on people as much, but that there are lesser forces that are being used in addition to the level of force.
That is Washington Post investigative reporter Kimbrielle Kelly here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about a piece that she and two colleagues published last fall, Forced Reforms, Mixed Results, a look at how consent decrees have worked in other cities. So, you know, as you know, Baltimore is here on the cusp of writing a consent decree and beginning that part of the process. Were there any ways that you found in looking at the cities you looked at that consent decrees were always successful, or elements that you found in a consent decree that was always successful?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that you see consistently across the board is, and you'll see this in Baltimore as well, I'm certain you will probably see this, you know, police departments immediately adopt new policies and do new training. And so they revise how officers are trained and the policies that are on the books. And so you have new standards. In some police departments, we saw that, and Puerto Rico was an example, an educational requirement was added. And so they considered that that was professionalizing the police force. So those are the things that you're probably going to see most immediately after the Baltimore consent decree is approved in the first couple years. But one of the things that people don't talk about a lot, which we found, was that these things are very expensive and often take a very long time. A lot of departments get into these agreements. They think that they're going to be about 4 or 5 year agreements, because in the consent decree, it will say how long it's going to be. And most of them are 4 and 5 years. One of the things that we found was that none of the departments that had ever been investigated by the Department of Justice in which there was a consent decree like Baltimore is going to have, none of them completed the agreements on time. And essentially what that means is every year the agreement is extended, that cost is shouldered by the taxpayers.
Let me mm-hmm. interrupt and ask you to give us an idea of what those costs cover. What kind of spending are we talking about year after year?
Oh, you're talking about personnel costs, training costs. One of the technology costs, one of the stories I just recently wrote was about early intervention systems. Baltimore has an early intervention system, but as you saw in their findings letter by the Department of Justice, it's very flawed, and it's not capturing the officers who might be on the path to wrongdoing. And so most of the departments have to put a new early intervention system in, and that could cost anywhere from, tens of thousands of dollars to hundreds of thousands of dollars each year and to maintain it. So there are personnel costs, there are database costs, warehousing costs, there's new training costs. And so, in Detroit, they had budgeted about $10 million a year. Most other departments are the same, $4 million, $10 million. L.A., they thought that they were going to do a five-year agreement, and so did Detroit. Both of those departments ended up in 11-year agreements. And for L.A., that ended up costing them minimum $300 million. And that's shouldered by taxpayers.
By local taxpayers. It does not tend to be covered by federal grants or federal money, correct?
No, it's just like your local police department is covered by local taxpayers. This is also shouldered by local taxpayers. And that's one thing that most people aren't aware of. And so they want to see these results that are very clear that there's, reformation in the police department, because these things are not expensive and they take a very, very long time to complete. And they actually take, the morale in some departments take a hit, which we've heard was the case in New Orleans. They're having a hard time recruiting people. They're knee-deep, I think, in the second or third year of the reform now, and they're having a hard time recruiting people into the academy, they said, because who wants to come join a police department that's under a cloud of a consent decree? It's been investigated by the Department of Justice, and so they were having a difficult time completing a full class in the academy, so much so that they just dropped their college requirement to be a police officer. And they just recently, in the last year, started advertising to come join their force on the tops of the Domino's pizza boxes. They said that that's how difficult it is working within these agreements and trying to get people to come join the force. So there are a lot of additional costs, and there are some non-financial aspects to these reforms that others don't consider until you're knee-deep in it.
You've teed up the last thing I wanted to ask you about before I have to let you go. I've read some comments, but I haven't gone deep into it the way I suspect you have, of experts being quoted that hiring standards may be more important to making permanent change in a police department than training or retraining. Did you pick up any insight into that question in looking at all the departments you looked at?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think, like I mentioned earlier, with Puerto Rico, they added an additional educational requirement to try to professionalize the force even more, and they completely revamped their training academy. So you're required to have, a college education. While New Orleans removed that requirement, it also came under a lot of criticism by the federally appointed monitor of New Orleans, who was not initially in favor of doing that. So you do see effort and a lot of attention being placed on professionalizing the police departments, requiring more education and requiring more training.
I said that was the last question, but I can't let you go without asking whether there's any particular advice you would have for the citizens and police officials who are going to be drafting this consent decree. Is there something you would warn them to stay away from?
I don't know about warning them, but I think the thing that I've found in talking to police departments all across the country is that it's a long process. I think that there's an expectation from folks that I've talked to that this change will happen overnight, or it'll happen after the first year or second year. And I think generally you see policy changes right off the bat. You see training changes, but some of those use of force numbers and complaint numbers that you want to see those numbers driven down, you don't see those until much later. And so I think from what I've heard from other people is that it requires a lot of patience. It requires a lot of collaboration between the Department of Justice and local officials and the monitors. And, you know, not having that collaboration can make this process drag out even longer.
I really appreciate your insights. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kimberly L. Kelly is a Washington Post investigative reporter. We've been talking about the piece that she and two other journalists published last fall, Forced Reforms, Mixed Results. We have to take a quick break here. When we come back, we'll talk with the organizers of a community town hall scheduled for tomorrow night about the process of reforming the Baltimore City Police Department and how the public can be involved. You can join this conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email, midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about the Justice Department report on the Baltimore police and what it will take to address the problems in that report. I'm joined now by two of the organizers of a community town hall taking place at the University of Maryland tomorrow night. The event is a chance for community members to share their ideas on how to improve policing practices, to share those ideas with the Department of Justice. With me in studio is Michael Pinard, a law professor at the University of Maryland and co-director of the clinical law program there. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you so much.
I'm glad you could join us. And joining us by phone is a community activist and actress, Sonia Sohn. You may know her from her portrayal of Kima on the HBO series The Wire. Welcome to Midday.
Hi, Sheila. Thank you for having me.
Sonia Sohn, do you think anything in the Department of Justice report surprised people who live in these communities?
Well, Sheila, I first want to say that I'm not an official organizer of the event, but I'm a supporter of the organizers of the event, and so I just want to make that clear. No, I don't think people of Baltimore are surprised by what was in the report. They might have been surprised. Well, let me just leave it right there for now.
Well, let me ask Michael Pinard a similar question. What was your reaction to the report?
Well, I agree that I don't think there were any surprises in the report. But I think what, you know, when you have 163 pages of violations and abuse and spelled out in detail and giving some of the stories of that men, women and children in this city have had to live. And then to me, the most shocking part of the report, if anything is shocking, is the extent to which complaints are made against officers internally and how certain violations are reclassified. So the report talks a lot about how there were all these complaints about racial slurs, but the city internally found only one instance of a racial slur, but they also found that all these other complaints had actually been reclassified. And so the level of sort of diversion, if you will, away from issues that are critically important, spelled out in this detail, and the total lack of accountability, it's not shocking, but to see it all in one document, I think, you know, obviously confirms the stories that so many people have told for decades. But certainly, you know, the weight of the issues, I think, are absolutely extraordinary. And so you see that spelled out in this report.
In an op-ed that you wrote for the Baltimore Sun, you made a distinction. You said reform of the police department is not enough, that the law enforcement culture has to change. Mm-hmm. I think I have some sense of what I might mean by that, mm-hmm. but I want to make sure I understand right. the distinction that you're making.
Well, what I'm saying is when you read this report and the weight of these issues, reform is a pretty humble goal, I think. That reform means, honestly, to form again in some other form. So you can improve something. You could tweak some training. You could tweak some policies. That doesn't really get at the issue. Cultural change to me means from the ways in which officers actually look at the community. So there was a quote in the Justice Department report that says, officers seem to view themselves as controlling the city rather than as part of the city. That's really what I mean by cultural change. They have to see themselves as part of the city at the first instance.
And how would you see that culture changing?
Well, it starts at the very, very beginning. So you, in the last segment, you talked a little bit about hiring. And, you know, we should be looking at, you know, officers who are willing to live in a city, certain requirements, certain cultural sensitivities, their familiarity with Baltimore, their ability to learn, their ability to reflect. Because any officer, as we all do in our lives, we make mistakes. But the ability to learn and reflect from your mistakes and be better because of those mistakes. You want to see an officer grow, right? You want to see them be a part of the community and cherish and value what is unique about all the communities in Baltimore. That's where it starts.
Sonia Son, one of the things that becomes clear, if people didn't already know it from reading the Department of Justice report, is a lack of trust between the police department and the community. What do you think the department can do to prove that it's committed to change?
I wish that was a question that I wish there was an easy answer to that question. I wish it could happen a lot quicker, a lot more quickly than it can actually occur. I think, you know, folks, by and large, police as well as community members know that the trust wasn't broken down overnight. It wasn't broken down within the last year. The trust was broken over a number of years through a number of former police commissioners and mayors. And this whole need to drive up the numbers and to hit quotas really destroyed. And then the actions like these pedestrian searches with less than 4% of folks arrested. You know, this trust was eroded over time, and I believe that what it's going to take is something very similar to what Michael Pinard said. It's really just a new culture. It's developing a new culture, and I don't know how possible that is with officers who've been on the job for a really long time and who've been trained in a particular way. You know, we all are walking through a world where we're subconsciously brainwashed all the time, and then on top of it, you know, we get, you know, training from we receive training when we join certain institutions that is flawed, and then that's also programmed, you know, into a person, and the undoing of that is, you know, it does take, you know, a certain type of individual, and it's going to certainly take a certain type of training, but I don't know. I mean, and it's got to take a certain kind of, it has to take a deep level of willingness. And I think there needs to be some sort of way to gauge that. What's the willingness of an officer who has been, you know, trained a certain way and to actually shift and to maybe see things from a different perspective?
That's actress and activist Sonia Son here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also here with me in the studio is law professor Michael Pinard. He is an organizer of a community town hall for policing reform that will take place tomorrow night at 6 p.m. at the University of Maryland Law School. You can join this conversation. Are you someone who distrusts the police in Baltimore? What could the Baltimore Police Department do to win back your trust? Give us a call, 410-662-8780, if you have some ideas about that. Or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Sonia Son, I'm particularly interested in what you think about culture, because I presume you tried to figure that out when you were playing a police officer, Kima, in The Wire. I mean, do you feel like you learned something about Baltimore police in that role?
I learned something about Baltimore police in that role, for sure. I mean, and whatever I might have learned was set forth primarily by Ed Burns, who was a former homicide and narcotics detective, who was one of the executive producers on the show, who was always educating us on the mindset, on, you know, how an officer would feel in a particular or react to something in a particular situation. But I will say I think I've learned more in the work that I've done, through the work that I've done in the city afterwards, and through my involvement with officers, you know, after I left the show. I mean, at the other, and I have to say that the community policing piece is really key to this as well as the training. And I think Chief Melvin Russell is doing a great job developing that community policing piece there, along with Commissioner Kevin Davis. It's definitely got to be a multi-pronged approach, but at the end of the day, the community policing officers are not patrol. They're not the quote-unquote narcos, you know, who are notorious for the way they police these communities. So yeah, I feel that there needs to be some sort of merging of the psychology of the that's used to train the community policing officers, as well as the patrol and the narcotics detectives as well.
Michael Pinard, I don't know whether I made it clear to listeners that you've been working in criminal justice in Baltimore for 14 years. So
right.
I turn to you for to clarify for me, if not mm-hmm. for our listeners, what do you mean by community policing?
Well, community policing, again, I think gets back to the culture change we're talking about. But it's about officers who are part of the community, right, who see themselves as partners with the community rather than adversaries, right, who do what they need to do to make the community safer, but also be an ally to everyone in that community. That is, you're a resource in that particular community. You're not just there to arrest, right? And in fact, the arrest should be the extreme circumstance. And again, I think when you see in this report the level of indignity that goes into just literally running people through the criminal justice system for no reason at all. Community policing is the opposite of that.
Is it a separate? I mean, the way Sonia was just describing it is sort of like a subset within the police department.
I mean, you
the community.
Well, you'd have a community policing division, but it's a methodology of policing. So I'd actually say it's broad. It's a way of policing. It's a methodology. It's how you see yourself in that particular community and how you are trained in ways to de-escalate, for instance. So you see a lot in this report about the failure of officers to de-escalate individuals, the failure of officers to understand and work with people who suffer from, you know, mental disabilities, the failure of officers to work with young and old folks who are African-American, the failure of officers to treat with dignity women who have been sexually assaulted, right? Community policing, again, you see yourself, you're an ally of these communities. You're not just there to enforce the law. That's a big part of your job. But again, you're there because you want to make the community safer. You want to make the community better.
So I listened to both of you, and I'd like to ask both of you: are you essentially saying we need a fresh crop of officers?
Well, I think that's a big part of it. I don't think anyone would disagree. I think again, as Ms. Sohn said just now, I think you certainly need to start with the hiring process to bring in officers who are sensitive to these issues, who could be trained effectively on these issues, and obviously that requires, you know, a training program that's robust and that the officers buy into. Again, you've seen this report. The report, and this is a quote, that the police department is indifferent to training, right? And so, yes, certainly that starts with that. That is, you have officers who have been repeat violators, whose stories jump off these pages, and there's been a lack of accountability, right? So certainly, yeah, you certainly need officers who will come in and will bring these new perspectives and will bring this sort of the necessary modes of policing.
So, Sonia-san, let me ask you the same thing. I mean, are you pinning your hopes on new officers who are not currently Baltimore police officers as opposed to people who currently work for the Baltimore Police Department?
Well, I think that it would be a little, personally for me, a little irresponsible for me to say that all right. the current police officers have to go, and I don't think that's what...
And let me be clear, that's exactly...
Mr. Bernard,
I did not say that at all. Right.
Right. So I just want to be clear.
Right.
Being someone whose whole life is built on my own story of redemption, I mm-hmm. have to believe that that's possible of any human being, including police officers. And I've met a number of police officers who genuinely care, who've just been beat down by the process, by the politics, the orders that come from political entities, that come from the command, that have to filter down to the you know, low man on the totem pole on the street, who are and there are those who have been reluctant to actually go out and have to drive up these numbers. Listen, you saw it on the wire, and that was true. I mean, you know, and so that has really beaten up the spirits of a lot of officers who would be probably much more who would probably fall under I guess in the category of those who should stay on the force and give it another try. I do believe, but I want to make this clear as well. I've gotten into in-depth conversation with detectives who have said to me directly, listen, some dudes just shouldn't be carrying a badge and a gun. And that happens way at the beginning of the process. So I've heard this directly, quote unquote, from Baltimore City, you know, police officers.
Michael.
You know, and once we get down this far, you know, then, you know, there needs to be some sort of methodology to sort of weed out those who are not ready to move forward.
Right.
Michael
Pinnell,
new day.
And let me just, again, I'm glad that Sonia Sohn clarified that. Certainly, so what I think we're both talking about is there are plenty of officers who are doing the jobs they're supposed to be doing, right? But then you have your other officers, and again, these are the stories that are reflected in the report, that are repeatedly violating the rights of people. Again, the report goes into detail about stories about racial insensitivity, about, you know, gender bias policing, right? So you have some officers, and you saw a couple of officers who actually were fired and let go after this report came out, who just really have no business being on the force. You have plenty of other officers who have every right and every need to be on the force. But again, we're talking about doing things differently, right? And so that's what I think we're both talking about.
But there is talk by critics of the blue wall of silence, mm-hmm. a tendency for officers to stand together mm-hmm. even in the face of wrongdoing.
Right.
So how do you address that?
Well, again, I think it goes to train. It goes to a sort of mindset of, again, we're here to protect the community. And again, this takes a long time. Right? This is, again, as your last speaker from the Washington Post stated, these changes cannot happen overnight. Changing a culture takes an incredible long period of time. You actually see stories in the report of officers who reported other officers and the ways in which they were retaliated against for reporting officers. But, you know, they were bold enough to do the jobs that they were supposed to do in that particular circumstance. But again, it goes with a whole sort of cultural mindset of we're here to protect the community, right? And the community is what comes first.
Sonia, we need to take a quick break. Is there a short point you want to make, or should we save it till after the break?
Save it till after the break.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break here, and you can join this conversation. Do you live in a community where police officers routinely clear corners? What do you think about the practice? Does it make you feel safer or less so? Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, we're talking today about the Justice Department report on the Baltimore Police Department and what it will take to address the problems exposed by that report. I'm speaking with University of Maryland Law Professor Michael Pinnard and community activist and actress Sonia Sohn. They are among the organizers of a community town hall on police reform that will take place tomorrow night at the University of Maryland Law School. And you can be part of this conversation. How do you think the problems with the Baltimore Police Department highlighted by the Department of Justice should be addressed? Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. Sonia, when we took a break, there was a point you wanted to make.
You were speaking about the blue wall of silence, which is I think something that everyone it's an aspect of police culture that everyone you know, all residents and community members have an issue with, and I think that one of the ways to dismount that, and I don't know if there is a dismantling of, because you know this is very, you know, the police are very akin to the military, and there's something that's gained from that deeper bond, which I have no real knowledge of, but I just have a vague sort of understanding of it. And for them, from what, you know, from my perspective anyway out here, I mean, I guess there's some part of it that's necessary, but there is a place where a police officer needs to step outside of that, and I that is to actually, you know, start to reward officers for being able. It's like being on a job, right? And there's unsafe conditions, and you know, you tell your boss there's unsafe conditions. You're helping, you know, you're helping your boss. You're helping the company that you work for. I think that there needs to be, you know, a whole different sort of approach to officers being able to move, being able to step forward. Because you have to remember, officers out here carrying guns, they're working with partners, and, you know, they don't want to be out on the streets and not feel safe themselves as a result of coming forward to try to improve, you know, the company they work for, so to speak. I think that we are going to miss a very important opportunity here if we don't really start talking a little bit more about the roots, the root causes of a lot of this. Because you see, right now, I think these policing reforms and, you know, the training and all of that, that's good, that's necessary. But all of this sits on top of a deep, deep culture of racism and implicit bias. And we're not saying that police officers are naturally racist, but let's just talk about, like, humanity at large in America, Americans at large. We all have some level of implicit bias working in our, you know, in our consciousness. And it takes a person who, you know, for me, I know what it takes for me to constantly untangle that day in and day out when I see my mind going one way, but I'm clear that the picture is actually, you know, that the picture's upside down and I have to right side it. That takes a certain kind of individual and a certain kind of person that is committed to seeing clearly. And when we talk about, you know, police officers, it just so happens that their job, undoing implicit bias, is critical to them doing an effective job in our communities in a way that's respectable. That's respectable. And I think that if we don't get down to talking about some of these root causes of the culture being the way it is, or the divide between the police and the community being the way it is, I don't know if these, you know, these techniques and these reforms are really going to stick. And then, you know, by the same token, you know, you have folks, you know, who are, you know, I mean, understanding the culture of the community. I mean, you're policing a community that is underserved, where, let's say, summertime, people don't have air conditioners, things are broken down. Folks, the life is lived on the street a lot of times. You know, you're sitting on your front porch steps and whatnot, which is, and people were being pulled off their front porch steps and harassed, you know. And I know that's a part of the report as well, but, you know, really understand the culture of the folks, but understand this. I'm not going to sit here and say that there aren't guys like on the corner that are like, you know, hawking drugs or whatever. But, you know, at the end of the day, these guys are doing the best they can with what they have, and there, you know, there does need to be some sort of, you know, management around all of that to keep, you know, folks safe and to keep, you know, people out of harm's way. But if we don't, you know, if we don't start really understanding that one thread is tied to the next, and finding a way to sort of weave these quote unquote reforms into the society itself, we need to, you know, reform folks' thinking.
Let's talk to Marcus, who's calling us from Baltimore with, I think, a point along those same lines. Marcus, welcome to Midday.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I've got one comment about changing the culture. The culture changes as you change the environment, and one of the ways you can do that is by recognizing the behavior that you want to see from your police officers. For example, there was a story today on local television about a couple of police officers somewhere in the United States that de-escalated a situation that could have been deadly. And they were actually recognized, obviously positively, for this kind of behavior. And I think this would go a long way to help change the culture.
Marcus, I appreciate the suggestion. Michael Pinard, what do you think about that?
I think it's very consistent with what Sonia just said in the last segment about the blue wall of science. I think that's absolutely right. That is, you start to recognize and value the attributes that we want or that the police higher-ups want to see and demand of their of officers. So absolutely, it's about, you know, accentuating the positive.
Peter Herman, who is an alumnus of the Baltimore Sun, now a reporter mm-hmm. for the Washington Post, wrote a piece last week about two competing, as it turned out, competing
right.
meetings at St. Peter Claver Church the week before that. One of people mm-hmm. doing part of what you're going to do tomorrow night, and we're going to talk about that in a minute, that is to say formulating suggestions for what should be in the consent decree. But another group meeting with Major I'm going to blank on her last name. Major Sherry Martin? I should have
right, from the Western District.
Yeah, Major Sherry Briscoe, excuse me, who
she's
runs
the command of the Western District.
The Western District, right. District mm-hmm. Where she was hearing a lot of residents saying, mm-hmm. we need tough policing on
right.
the street corners.
Right.
We won't feel safe
right.
if there are a lot of
right.
Young black men loitering mm-hmm. around. So isn't some of the pressure on the police coming from the citizens?
Well, look, you can go to communities all across this country, and I don't think anyone will dispute that communities need strong, effective police leadership, right? Again, they're there to protect the community. So I don't think anyone would disagree with it. The issue is how do you go about doing that? That's the question. That's the big question, is how do you go about doing that? So it's absolutely right. You know, communities, you have victims and you have offenders who live in very, very close contact to each other, right? So there's definitely a need to promote and protect the integrity and safety of the citizens. But you don't protect communities by violating rights left and right. That really doesn't get you anywhere, right? All it does is get people upset, right? And it lets community distrust you. So, for instance, Sonia Stone mentioned, it's in the report, the 300,000 stops, right, from 2010 to 2015, contraband was found on 3.7% of the individuals, right? When you pull people over for driving, right, which the report talks about the disparities between black and white who are pulled over, contraband is actually found more on white drivers than black drivers by, I think, five times as much, right? But yet, black men and women and children are being pulled over much more frequently. So that's not the way to go. That you don't protect communities doing that. You don't protect communities by literally arresting people, putting them through central booking, letting them be released the next day without being charged. The report also talks about officers failing to show up in court, right? So cases have to be dismissed. And so if you want strong, effective policing, and we all do, again, the cultural change is necessary. There has to be respect there for people who are engaged in criminal activities as well as those who are victimized by it. So I agree. But the issue is, how do we go about doing that?
Natasha has called us from Randallstown. Natasha, welcome to Midday.
Hi. I was wondering, is the shakeup going to address?
We seem to have lost.
Is it going to address the Fraternal Order of Police who shadows bad police officers and rules and regs and bends?
Natasha, I appreciate the question. Let me ask you.
It's in the report. The report talks about some of the protections that are afforded to police officers and law enforcement Bill of Rights here in this city. It's 40 years old at this point. It's one of the strongest for police officers in the country. There's been lots of activity in our legislature over the past couple of years trying to change some of those requirements and protections, and so that's part of an ongoing conversation. So we'll see where that goes. But certainly it is part of the conversation.
So you're having this town meeting tomorrow night. Tell me briefly what's going to happen and what you expect to come from it.
Right. So Legal Defense Fund, NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, has conducted these town halls across the country, most recently in North Charleston after the killing of Walter Scott. So they're really running the show tomorrow. We're organizing this with them. But the purpose of this town hall is for people to go on the record and tell the Department of Justice what policing should look like in Baltimore. So the DOJ, where we are in the process now, is that Department of Justice and the city of Baltimore is negotiating a consent decree. A consent decree is essentially an agreement, right? That is, you have to do all these different things that are spelled out in agreement. They'll be monitored. They want to wrap up the negotiations by November 1st of this year. As part of that process, they want community input on what policing is it will should look like, and they will then incorporate that input into their negotiations with the city that will then result in this consent decree. So these meetings have been going on all around Baltimore. Tomorrow night, it'll be at the University of Maryland Law School in Westminster Hall, which is at 519 West Fayette Street. That's between Parker and Green. So after some opening remarks from the dean of the law school and from Sherilyn Eiffel, who is the president and director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and from Congressman Elijah Cummings, it will turn into a town hall. And individuals, you will have 2 minutes to speak about what the future of Baltimore should look like. If you do not have time to speak tomorrow night, or if you just don't want to talk tomorrow night, there'll be an opportunity to provide some comments in writing. There'll be forms that we'll pass around, and all that information will go to the DOJ.
So the comments that people make tomorrow night will be?
Will go to the Department of Justice. There will be a Department of Justice attorney there who will give an overview of this report, and they will also have some attorneys from the Department of Justice who will be in the audience to answer any questions. If people want to talk with them one-on-one and provide that input, they'll be there tomorrow night.
One of my questions, and Sonia Stone, I don't know whether it's fair to throw this at you, but it is my impression that a lot of the structure and policies of the Baltimore Police Department are actually governed by state law. And this, as Michael Pinard just reminded us, is a negotiation between the city and the Department of Justice. How hopeful are you that this process can actually make the changes that you think need to be made?
If I'm honest, I would say that I'm conflicted about this process. I'm probably reflective of a great number of people who feel that the systems and the structures that are in place, including this you know the DOJ's this consent decree, the DOJ from which the dissent decree comes, at this point, to me, those structures even need to be, and the way we're going about this needs to shift and change and evolve if we are really going to get to the bottom of these issues and actually see a change that's more than a surface level change. But this is what we have, and because this is what we have, I participate and I encourage others to participate. We cannot just sit back and complain if we do not show up in these moments where we do have, you know, a small iota of power. We do have to exercise what little power and voice that we have, and this is why I'm encouraging people to show up and to speak their minds about this process.
We are flat out of time, Sonia Stone. I really appreciate your sharing your thoughts with us today. Sonia Stone, community activist and actress, thank you so much. And thank you, University of Maryland Law Professor Michael Pinard. The Community Town Hall on Police Reform tomorrow night, 6 to 9 p.m. at Westminster Hall, 519 West Fayette Street. An opportunity for the public to present suggestions on police reform to the Justice Department. Thanks also to Washington Post reporter Kimberly L. Kelly, who joined us earlier this hour. And I want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch. Serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, local craft beers, locations and hours at joesquared.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. What if a massive flu pandemic hit Maryland? Who should have priority for care? Who should decide and how? I'm Sheila Cast. I hope you have a great afternoon, and you'll join us again tomorrow.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.